Today on Noteworthy Networks, we have Dr. Jeff Lambert to share just a snippet from his bio. You should know that Jeff is the education coordinator for Crisis Center North, a nonprofit counseling and resource center for survivors of domestic violence located in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Dr. Jeff's role pertains to providing prevention education for youth and communities to inform them about services, resources, and learn how to develop healthy relationships. He, of course, is an alumnus of the University of Central Arkansas, class of 2011, having graduated with a Bachelor of Arts in Philosophy and Religious Studies. From there, he went on to graduate from Duquesne University in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, with a Master's in Philosophy in 2014 and a Doctorate in Philosophy in 2020. With all that said, welcome, Dr. Jeff.
Hello, thank you for having me.
You're welcome. I'm ready to dive in and learn a little bit more about your career and what sort of took you from getting degrees in philosophy to now becoming the education coordinator for Crisis Center North.
It's a fair question. Yeah. I guess I can start with, you know, when I started going to UCA, my interest was in psychology, and I was really engaged in like doing more counseling work. And that sort of the philosophy and religious studies classes that I was doing really let me play around more with the practice of thinking about what it means to be a person who is engaging with others just on a day-to-day basis, right? And so it was taking that counseling interest that I had and kind of making it expanded out into the bigger picture of how this interacts with everyone, thinking about it in terms of the ethics and those sorts of things. And so I decided that was really kind of the path I wanted to pursue, even though I still have like that soft spot for counseling and psychology. And so then Tane Duncan, who is the chair of the Philosophy and Religious Studies Department right now, I believe, she was just hired as I was like leaving the program. So I think she started in 2010 and I graduated in 2011 And she came from Duquesne. She got her PhD in Duquesne. And when I was talking to her about going to graduate programs, she just recommended, she was like, you know, I really think this was a good fit for the kind of things that, you know, we had very similar interests. She's like, the things that you're interested in seem like they line up with what I did at Duquesne. And Charles Harvey, who was the chair at the time when I was there, also recommended, he's like, you know, Tane had such an amazing CV, resume. You know, this was someone who had a really strong background in the history of philosophy. And that was what I wanted to have too. So I applied to it, got in, really enjoyed the master's program, was lucky enough to get into the PhD as well. And it was when I started teaching through the PhD process that I realized what a strong passion I had for teaching and education in general. And then I realized that, you know, the issues that I had with philosophy were that sometimes it seems so distant from interacting with everyday lived experience. You know, we talk in conferences, we meet, we have like discussions with students, but it's not actually making it an active process. It's not making it something that's a lived experience. And so I started in my teaching incorporating a community engagement aspect. So I would require students to do service work and I would require them to journal about that and present about that. And that kind of made me start to feel like, you know, this is really where the vital energy of philosophy is for me. And that kind of got me thinking, you know, I can do something in education. I remember I went to someone and I said like, you know, God, I really wish there was some kind of job I could get that was working in community engagement to educate others. And then out of nowhere, this position kind of popped up and I was like, oh my gosh, it does exist. That is a thing. And I was lucky enough to get hired at Crisis Center North. So I'm really enjoying it now.
Okay. So one might ask, then why are you not just doing the professor route where you like to teach? You could still, I guess you could say, I mean, I guess you're not really getting to get out in the field. Is that what it is? Or
I think that I still love teaching. I stay in touch with everyone at Duquesne too, and have let them know that I'm available to teach. Like I was teaching last semester, and I'm open to teaching next semester, maybe next spring, just as they need me, because I do really enjoy it. The professor route though, I think that academia is maybe about to go through a sort of shift, And I think that the pandemic has accelerated that shift a little bit in thinking about, we really need to be more catered to the students' needs, and realizing that that might include more of an off-campus focus. It might include more of a focus on the academics instead of strengthening. Because I think a lot of campuses focus on making their campus attractive, thinking about making their facilities attractive. And that's awesome, right? That's something we want. We want students to want to come to our schools. But as we consider the possibility that online virtual learning is going to continue to be a part of our lives, probably for the future going forward, then I think that the pathway of academia is going to change a little bit. And I think that there's going to be some awkward growing pains right now. And when I was, so I was a visiting assistant professor at Teal College as well up in Pennsylvania. And it was going through that with them, going through that with Duquesne, when they had to adjust during the pandemic, I realized that this is probably just a time and a place where the way I like to teach is particularly difficult to do in an academic setting. I like to do engaged stuff. I like to get students out there. And thinking about that track going forward, the fact that I would have to prove myself in another avenue, right? I'd have to, rather than just being the kind of person who teaches and has the teaching awards and the teaching history, I'd have to go and, you know, publish in these certain journals that are the only ones that, you know, the different academics care about, right? And I have published things. I like that. I present at conferences, but my passion has always been in education. And I think that that passion is going to be looked at much more favorably in the coming years. But right now, that's a slight barrier that I think some people have to be aware of. You know, that's going to be more of an issue of how do we adjust the job market to account for those things. And I'm not sure if it's really doing that yet.
Yeah, that makes sense. All right. How did you become interested in both nonprofit and specifically, I guess, working with survivors of domestic violence? I know you said that you like the education piece. You wanted to be able to utilize community engagement. So why the nonprofit world, and then specifically with working with survivors of domestic violence?
Yeah, that's a good question. As I mentioned, I think that in my teaching, I started to get really exposed to the nonprofit world. That was one part of it. My wife is also in the nonprofit world. I met her volunteering for her when she was a volunteer coordinator. And it was, you know, we both were sort of like interested in each other, but it was not okay because I was a volunteer and she was a volunteer coordinator. So it was once things really picked up with the PhD and I wasn't able to keep going for a little while that she was like, hey, since you're not staff anymore, can I reach out to you? And so we started talking to each other, and that, you know, has been wonderful. But then being exposed to her world more has kind of opened up to me more of how nonprofit action accomplishes so much. And so I wanted to be a part of that change. I wanted to be a part of something that was making our communities better, making our worlds more livable. And as far as the interest in domestic violence, my mom, she ran away from home when she was a teenager because of her abusive father. And, you know, my grandmother went with her to get out, but she, you know, it wasn't my grandmother's idea. It was my mom's idea to get out. And then the grandmother went with her. And I think that that has always kind of made me aware of how important it was that my mom had the kind of support system that she found. She sort of was lucky enough to stumble into support systems that helped her and her mom. And realizing that not everyone has that support system, right? That not everyone's lucky enough to just stumble into the people who will help you and support you, made me think how important it is to work for an organization that does that already, right? That is kind of being that support network for those people. So that's kind of, I think, the basics of that one.
Yeah. Thanks for sharing that. That's a little bit of a powerful story. It's like, you know, people live these everyday lives and sometimes people don't even get to hear these types of like stories. Moving into like your education and your training and your background, what kind of education, training, background would you suggest an education coordinator would require?
Yeah. So, I mean, my background is a little bit unconventional for the standard education coordinator. You know, most people who do this job have masters in education or, you know, an MSW, Master of Social Work. My route, because of my consistent interest in teaching through community engaged approaches, that is what made me a candidate. But I think that, you know, while I think that going for a master's of education or a master's of social work, something related to counseling fields, definitely makes you a clear-cut path, that something I'd like to remind everyone is that, you know, your degree doesn't limit you if you feel like afterwards you want to go a different route. You know, the ability to reinvent yourself is always there. You just have to think about how you can pull on the strengths you already have. And so, you know, I was realizing that I wanted to shift out of the academic range of, you know, the professor path that you mentioned, right? Because of the things that I had pointed out earlier. And in that, I was thinking, well, I really want to focus more on nonprofit. I have justifiable reasons for why I should count as a candidate. So I just need to play those up in my cover letter. I need to play those up with the references I use. So rather than just using people who were on my dissertation committee, like I would for a professor position, I asked for people from the Center for Teaching Excellence, from the Center for Engaged Teaching and Research. I asked for someone who's a community leader. That was, I think, central to me. And I think another part that really, you know this, working in career services, that it really all comes down to connections. It comes down to making that network of people that you can reach out to that always keep you in mind. So that was something that I think also made me a possible candidate. So those are the intangibles, right? There's the clear path and there's the unclear path.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for that reminder. That's definitely going to be good for our listeners and our students to hear too. What kinds of accomplishments tend to be valued and rewarded in your career? You can talk specifically as now being the education coordinator at the Crisis Center North, or you could talk, you know, generally about in nonprofit work.
I think I can speak more, you know, concretely to my position as an education coordinator, someone doing prevention education. And I think that there are going to be awards typically handed out by the government for nonprofit service. So one of the prevention educators I work with, you know, he's been doing this for 25 years. He's near retirement and he has won those awards, right? And so I've just gotten started. This is my first year of doing this. And so those are, you know, hopefully in the future, but not yet. And then, but those are things that are helpful. So just getting that recognition of the kind of mentor and leadership qualities that you have. And then the other really measurable aspect of your success is grant writing. And I think that this is one of the times when being someone who is in philosophy as opposed to counseling or education has really been helpful, because having that those writing skills to be convincing, to be consistent logically, have been really helpful for me. And so I think that those abilities are what get measured the most. Other than that, you know, it's something that I think a lot of people call, and I know that some people call them soft skills, and people are also starting to push back on that, like we shouldn't call them soft skills, you know, but it's these ideas of communication, teamwork, being there for, and just kind of stepping up, always being willing to say like, oh, I'll take the initiative and I'll work on that for you. It seems like we need to do this. I'll do that. That is the kind of action that gets you recognition within your workplace. But as far as, you know, outside the field, if you want to be like known to other education coordinators or recognized as like, if you want to move on from one agency to another, then having that history of grant writing success or the history of awards is something that would, you know, merit you as a worthy candidate.
Yeah. So to your point on soft skills, we've moved into calling them power skills for our students when we do presentations on them.
I like the idea of using power skills as a term to describe it better. You know, I think that because they are really empowering and powerful for you as an individual and for your team to have those skills. So yeah, I think calling them soft skills does them a discredit.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. I think my question was, with grant writing, did you have that prior experience going into this position? Or, I mean, I know you spoke on you have writing skills, but had you actually done any kind of grant writing or experience with that?
Yeah. So I had applied for a few grants. I think it was between 3 and 5. I know I received 3. I might've applied for 5. But it was, you know, some travel grants. When I was doing an internship with the Center for Engaged Teaching and Research, I applied for an internship grant to kind of help fund me, reimburse for like parking, things like that. Like nothing too significant in terms of, you know, the monetary value received, but still, it was enough to say, you know, I've done this. I've argued for my case for why I deserve this, and it's been successful. And that was helpful. And I think that picking some of that, you know, some of these were low hanging fruit, like the internship grant was really easy. And I encourage anyone doing an internship to pursue some sort of grant, because it is unfortunate that so many internships are unpaid. Mm-hmm. Some of them, like the language travel abroad grant that I received, like that was something that, you know, required a little bit more work, a little bit more effort to do. There was another conference and workshop that I really wanted to go to for the American Association of Philosophy Teachers. And they do a kind of a, I think it's a biannual conference and workshop. And in order to get into that workshop, you had to apply and get accepted. And then you also had to write a grant asking for travel funds and housing funds. So I wrote for that and received that.
All right. Adding little tools into your toolbox as you go. Yeah.
And I think a lot of that, to Duquesne's credit, a lot of that is things that they really encouraged us to do. So I think that, you know, in any graduate program that I've heard of, I know I've heard about this at UCA too, it was the graduate students are really encouraged to develop those skills and kind of diversify their strengths. So I think that's a really good skill that grad schools tend to make sure students get.
Yeah, for sure. Can you share a little bit about what you like most about your work?
Yeah. So it has been different with the pandemic. You know, I don't get to go into very many schools, but there is one school that I get to go into in person, because now that I'm fully vaccinated, because of ways that things are being distributed based on mm-hmm. my organization counts as a healthcare facility as well. And that being there in person with the students is something that I've always enjoyed. I've always enjoyed getting to work with them. I also enjoy being able to kind of orchestrate with the teachers how this programming can work along with what they're doing in class right now. There's a teacher that I'm working with who has been covering social contract theory in their seventh grade social studies class. And I was like, oh, I love social contract theory. Like, I'm a philosopher. Like, of course, I've done a lot of research on this. And, you know, that area in the kind of the time period, right? The time period of early modern philosophy, where a lot of that work was being done. That's my specialty. So I was able to work with that teacher and say, like, okay, so let's talk about framing healthy relationships in terms of a social contract. And I think that I really like problem solving that and making it something that students can become interested in, because it becomes so relevant to making them succeed in other areas. So talking to students about, you know, what are your concerns about your healthy relationships? What are the healthy relationships you want to have? You know, and so sometimes it's going to be with their teammates. Sometimes it's going to be with their best friends or their family, or, you know, you get a lot of them, they're like, well, I really want to have a good, healthy dating relationship. I want to teach me how to get dates. And it's like, well, I can't teach you how to get dates, but I can teach you how to recognize that a relationship is healthy. And let's work on that.
Yeah. How much of your job is going out into the field, like you were saying, or did you do any kind of like virtual meetings with schools? And then how much of it is you're writing grants, like a day-to-day basis?
Yeah. On a day-to-day basis, most of it is, you know, virtually going into schools or going physically into schools. The grant writing, it was really heavy early on because I kind of got hired in the grant writing season. And so that was something now we're waiting to hear back on those. Mm-hmm. And some of that's been delayed because of the pandemic. Some of the institutions that were offering those grants have been saying, you know, well, we're kind of trying to pivot more towards vaccine funding, but we're going to get back to you, right? And which is totally understandable, right? But it's the recognition that some of these things happen in seasons. And so like in the summer, I'm not going to be going into schools, but I am working to get into summer camps. And so those are some things that, you know, trying to maximize your time, trying to think about like, well, I always have to be thinking about the future. So a lot of it isn't just grant writing or actually doing programming. A lot of it is thinking about how you can make your position consistently valuable to the organization, even no matter what season it is. So I think that's being always having that foresight is important.
Yeah. So what age of youth do you typically work with? I know you mentioned the seventh graders.
Yeah, right now I mainly work with fifth, sixth, seventh, and eighth. But in the fall, I'm expecting to start working with 10th, 11th, and 12th. And in next spring, there is hope that I can be, we already have the relationship started, but it's just about like where everything is with the pandemic. In next spring, we're hoping that I can be in the a detention facility, right? A juvenile detention facility, and working with those youth, which could be, you know, anywhere from 9th to 12th, basically.
Okay. So there's not really any, I guess, limits or constraints with the type of youth that you could work with.
Sure. And I also do work with college students, and I work with community groups of adults. You know, those are things that are a part of building up that strength, building up that network of support and resources. But, you know, the bulk of my work is working with younger audiences.
Okay. And do you reach out to them to partnership with them, or do they reach out to you? How does that work?
It's kind of a mix. When they are inside what's called our encatchment area for the nonprofit, because, you know, Pittsburgh's a big city. We have a lot of domestic abuse shelters and crisis centers that can offer services. But we also realize that since it's a big city, it's hard to cover all of it with one organization. So we've sort of cut out different parts of the map as being our primary service area, and we call that the encatchment area. And I can solicit anyone inside my encatchment area. And then for people outside of that, we are able to work out partnerships with them if they solicit us. And we just have to say, like, hey, we're happy to work with you. Just to let you know, there are all these, some of these services are also offered from other shelters. But, you know, if you're having trouble scheduling with them, we're happy to work with you. That way we're not, you know, poaching clients or service codes from anyone else.
Yeah. All right. Now that you've talked about what you like most about your work, what do you like least about your work?
There's nothing I dislike about the actual work right now, but I do dislike the fact that currently, you know, I'm working from home, and I think that not being able to get to know my colleagues, not being able to see the work that they do on a daily basis, because our work, you know, we're all working to help solve the problem of domestic violence, but seeing the way they do it and the different shape that takes for them and their daily experiences is something that's been enjoyable for me the few times I've been able to work with them. And not having access to that is a bit disappointing. So that's something that, you know, we try to make up for it with, you know, meetings and phone calls, Zoom chats, and we have Slack all the time that's going, and all that's great, but it doesn't make up for the same office atmosphere. You know, when I was teaching at Duquesne or Teal, it was great to be able to wander into different faculty meetings and just, you know, talk with everyone, say like, okay, well, what are you doing? Let me kind of glean a little bit from that experience and take some of that and put it into my work. And the other prevention educator and I, we meet, you know, multiple times a week over Zoom and talk about what we're doing. And that's really energizing for us. But we've said, you know, it would be so great if we could just talk to each other in person, if we could walk through some of what we're doing in person with each other as opposed to virtually. So I think that's what I dislike.
Yeah. Virtual is different than in person.
Yeah.
All right. Have you faced any challenges in your work? I know you mentioned the, you know, not being able, have you faced any other challenges in your work?
The only challenges that I can really think of right now are just, you know, when you're working with particularly universities that are, you know, and you're thinking about introducing us as a partner, as a resource for students, universities who have their own counseling services can sometimes, the counseling departments themselves can get a little bit defensive because they worry about, like, you know, are they going to be taking my job from me? Is my job going to become obsolete if this, you know, domestic violence agency comes in and starts offering counseling? And it's really kind of convincing them that we're complimentary, right? Convincing them that, you know, there's no need to worry. We want you guys to be there. We want you to be offering the services you have for students because they're so important. We just also want you to recognize that we can help do things like find housing for people, find, you know, transportation and legal support for people that maybe you're not as skilled in, as fluent in. And that is something that, you know, you get a little bit of a pushback. And there's also going to be, you know, some concerns about confidentiality because we, you know, are completely confidential. All of our services are completely confidential, but universities understandably want to be able to say like, well, we need to know that you've received our student. We need to know that you've been talking to them. It's like, well, we can do that if the student signs a confidentiality, you know, release, but we can't do that just normally because of that's just how confidentiality works. And I think that something that universities maybe sometimes lose sight of because they are dealing with a delicate transition point in a person's life, but it is easy to think of them as still kids or teenagers, and recognizing their adulthood and their individuality and their legal status is something that you just kind of have to gently remind them about. So I think that's something that's sometimes a challenge, but overall something that's a good learning experience for everyone involved. It helps me understand how we can work to solve this problem. You know, I understand that they can't just not know anything about whether or not their students have received services. So I can give them some aggregate data, like, you know, well, we've served this many people from this school, but I can't give you any names or identifying information about them. I can just give you a number. And if that matches up with the number of referrals you made, great. If it doesn't, then maybe there's something else that we can talk about, right? Some other ways that we can kind of ask the students to report to you on their own terms, right? Mm-hmm. But we can't do that for them. But yeah, those are some of the few challenges.
Yeah. All right. Among challenges that you've faced, I know you spoke a little bit about how the pandemic has affected your career. Do you have any other stories or things you would like to share about how COVID-19 has impacted you?
Yeah, sure. There are a couple. I guess one of them is that, you know, we used to do programming, which was basically just awareness raising about domestic violence with particularly hair salons, because hair salons are places where people are isolated away from abusers, right? It's not a counseling session or something like that, but it's also something that's a consistent appointment. You know, most people are seeing their going to a hair salon monthly or every few months, and being able to have that constant interaction. If the hair salon worker can say, "Hey, I'm a little concerned. You seem really quiet. What are these bruises? You know, are you feeling okay? Are you feeling safe? Because you seem really meek or unsettled." Something like that, even just having the posters up in the hair salons is something that can do a lot for us. But with the pandemic, fewer people are going to get haircuts. You know, my wife cuts my hair. And there's also the fact that it's been really unfortunate that so many small businesses have closed due to the pandemic. So it was somewhere between 50 and 70% of our partner hair salons permanently closed down during that period. And so that's a challenge. And kind of adding to that, there's also, you know, when you are a nonprofit, you thrive off of community fundraising, right? And that is difficult to do when everyone's hurting. Mm-hmm. So being more creative about that, thinking about it in terms of, okay, if we're going to do something like an auction during an event, well, maybe restaurants aren't comfortable giving like gift certificates or something like that because they're struggling. But what they could do is maybe have like their chef run a virtual cooking class, and we can give, you know, some sort of fair market value for that, so that during auction, people can bid on that. You know, that's something that people who are, you know, we're all bored and staying home and being safe and having something to look forward to on a weekend, you know, like a cooking class, something like that, that's fun, is an attractive prospect. So being more creative, you know, I think that the pandemic, the challenges it's posed has been met by creativity. And, you know, not being able to go into schools in person. Well, okay, well, we use Nearpod, which I'm not sure if you're aware of or have ever heard of before, but it's a like an online learning environment. And you can sync your PowerPoint presentations directly to it. You can record audio along with it. You can do them as live presentations where students can kind of follow along at their own pace. And you can also make them asynchronous so that students have constant access to those lessons. So that's something that for those schools that we can't get into, which we've been able to, you know, fortunately get into almost all of our partner schools. But for the ones that we're trying to get into or that we can't get into consistently, having those asynchronous options that are really easily accessible, because Nearpod doesn't require an account, right? You can use it on your phone. All you have to do is like put in a code and you're there. That kind of, you know, research and creativity that we've been able to have on our side has been really helpful for getting us there. And I think that, you know, it helps that we have a really diverse background in all of our staff. You know, our executive director and assistant director used to be professors in communication. And I come from a background of education. We have a lot of masters in social work, people working with us. We have a lot of lawyers working for us. And so, you know, we all have that skill set and that history that we just share together. And that's why I think that I really miss out on being in the office, because there's so many awesome, great people there that I want to be able to talk with them and kind of solve more problems. But when we are able to work together, we solve the problems really well. So,
yeah. About how many schools are you in Are they just public schools or?
So we're in 11 different school districts. And right now, just to give you an idea, we've reached, I think it's 7,000 student encounters. So yeah, wow. we're pretty active. And our goal is for every year to hit 10,000. I think we're going to be really close, even with the pandemic, to hitting that goal. So I think that that's, you know, that feels really good to be successful during a really challenging year. And then, you know, we're in a couple different colleges. I'm actually partnered with Tane Duncan's course at UCA right now. She has some students that are doing some remote service work for me. And I've done presentations for them just talking about, because she likes to frame it in terms of a global duty to do that community engagement. Mm-hmm. So it was really cool that she invited me to work with her for the course that she's doing. And the Community College of Allegheny County is a university here in Pennsylvania that we've worked with consistently. And I of course have connections with Duquesne that I've tried to, you know, build on as I've gotten here.
Yeah. That's awesome. That's awesome that you're still going to be able to hit your numbers too with coming up with those creative ways to do things virtually too.
Yeah. We're really, you know, that was a huge sigh of relief, but also, you know, one of those things where I was like, yeah, okay. It does pay off to keep doing this work, to keep being dedicated.
What do you recommend to students who are about to join the workforce when it comes to facing challenges, whether it's pandemic related or other hot topic issues that have surfaced over the last year to year and a half?
Yeah, I was actually just giving a presentation to some other PhD students who were kind of worried about, you know, the job market and thinking about non-academic jobs and ways that they could pursue that. And the concerns that I hear a lot are, how do I frame my skills? Like I know how to talk about my skills in my field. How do I translate those into being applied to a different field? And I think one of the best ways to do that is get someone in a different field, a friend, to look at your materials and say, like, and just talk to them about the experiences you've had and have them repeat back to you what you've done, you know, have them say it in their own words. So mm-hmm. It's okay. Well, I've done 6 years of teaching. Okay. So you've done 6 years of program development and implementation. That's what teaching is, right? You're coming up with a program, you're coming up with a course plan and kind of talking about it in that way, right? Thinking about it in terms of, you know, have you been on committees? Have you done any volunteer work? Have you done this or that? You know, thinking about that in terms of defining the power skills or defining them as ways that you've already put your toe in the water of this field is really important. And I also just think it's really so important to reach out to everyone that you can to think of as, if they have been supportive of you and, you know, at a university level, the university wants you to succeed. Mm-hmm. So reaching out to those people at the university and saying like, hey, you know, I know that we had a talk once or twice and it was really positive for me. I don't know if you remember me, but it'd be really awesome to talk with you about some possible job prospects. You know, they're always going to say, of course, I remember you. That's so great. I'd love to talk with you. And, you know, they are going to want to be that reference for you. They're going to want to see you succeed. And so meeting with them to give them a background on how you're selling yourself on the market is really important. I also think that diversifying your approach to finding a job is important. You know, you can't just say like, okay, well, I put myself on Indeed. I put myself on LinkedIn. You know, you need to do all of it. And that's hard. It is work. It's work to get a job to do work. But it is important to do that. And I also think I don't particularly enjoy social media. I don't have a Facebook. I don't have Instagram or any of those things. But I think that a LinkedIn account is something that is kind of a necessary evil. It's just something we have to do. And working through that is important. And getting someone, I talked to my friend who is in career services at a university in Oregon. Mm-hmm. And I talked to him about like, you know, can you kind of just walk me through, just because I was like, he's been my best friend. He went to UCA. And so it was, you know, talking with him about that and saying, you know, what can I do here? And he gave me a great seminar on how to kind of tailor my LinkedIn page to be more accessible, advertise to myself a little bit more, and how to reach out to people and make those connections. So, I mean, really leaning on those supports is, I think, a great way to kind of get into a career.
Yeah. Awesome. Awesome advice. All right. How does your job affect your general lifestyle?
I have to go to bed pretty early because a lot of times getting into, you know, some of these schools, which can be kind of a drive if it is an in-person visit, means I have to be up around, you know, 5:30, 6 o'clock. That's something that, you know, it's just like, okay, well, I'm used to the college professor kind of thing where it's, you know, you teach typically around, you know, the Tuesday, Thursday, 10, mm-hmm. 10 and 2. And then you have a lot more time to work on those programs as you're doing them, those classes. You can really fiddle with them up until the last minute. I think the other thing is when you're doing programming for a nonprofit that is meant to have like a system of evaluation, meant to be consistently the same product, there's less of that fine tuning that you want to do because you don't want one school to get a completely different experience than another. And so I think, you know, whereas it's totally fine if one of your Tuesday, Thursday classes is covering one topic and the other Tuesday, Thursday class is covering a different topic at a university level, even if they're the same class, it's not a great thing if you're doing that at a, this kind of level of prevention education. So that's something that's been a slight adjustment for me because I was always the person who tinkered with my classes up until the last minute. And I always, you know, ask my students, what topics do you want to cover to make this relevant to your experience and the kind of the learning that you want to get relevant to the career you want to follow? Because I do think that philosophy is, again, always has to be something that applies to your life as you're living it. But
yeah. Yeah. What steps would you recommend to a student to take to prepare to enter your field of work, either nonprofit or working with survivors of domestic violence and education prevention, or wanting to become an education coordinator?
Yeah. So, you know, it was when I was talking with some of those PhD students, there were a handful of them that were really like, you know, you have my dream job. I really want to do this kind of work with education coordination. Like I want to do nonprofit work. And I was telling them, you know, the best thing you can do is there are those resources at your university. Talk to the people, talk to your advisor, talk to your director of whatever, you know, undergrad process or just your favorite professor about like, what are the resources that are here that I can look to as a way to kind of get me some skills as like an intern for maybe the engaged teaching or research place here, right? That's going to have a different name at every university. Mm-hmm. But getting that skill there, volunteering through the education coordination position, right? There's going to be, you know, if you can contact someone who is the education coordinator for an organization you want to work with and say, hey, I'm so interested in the work that you're doing. Is there any way I could volunteer or shadow you or do some sort of internship? Right? Getting that interest, like this is a welcoming field. It's one that wants and needs new people. Because another thing that is unfortunate is there is a lot of burnout in the nonprofit world. You know, people, it's tough. And so we're always looking to get more people engaged with it because that eases the load off of all of us. So we're not going to turn you down if someone comes to us. So I think it really comes down to having that belief in yourself, the confidence to say, I can and should ask about how I can help and contribute to this. And that's something that I think is really important. If you are on a specifically like highly academic track, then there's probably someone in your field that's publishing on education and nonprofit work that you can try to work with and present at a conference with, or maybe work possibly publish with, right? And so those are things that are other possible ways to do that.
Yeah. What steps would you suggest to students going into college and thinking forward towards their careers?
Take a minute. Take a minute to, I think that it's easy to go through the education conveyor belt and never have to think about why you're doing it. And mm-hmm. I think that's something that philosophy is so helpful with, is the thinking about the why, taking the pause, being self-reflective. And so I think that having that minute to think about why am I doing this? What do I want to do? What are the things that make me happy? That's so important. Take that time. You know, if it's going to be a summer, if it's going to be just a semester where you get out some of those general education skills that you need to do, right? That's important. But I think that it's also about being fully invested in those courses. You know, I think that a lot of my friends when I was an undergrad were taking those general education courses and just thinking like, all right, I have to get this out of the way. Don't think of it as something you have to get out of the way. Think of it as an opportunity to find something new that really empowers you and makes you feel confident in your engagement with the world. So that's something I would kind of do that to kind of, I would tell them, enjoy every single one of those experiences and reflect on how it could or could not be relevant to you in the future.
Yeah, great advice. What are three key takeaways you would give to students about to graduate from college?
It's a good question. I would say maybe to be patient with yourself and with others. You know, it's going to be difficult sometimes to be around family or friends who are constantly checking in with you about, like, well, how's it going out there? What's the job market look like? What are you doing? You know,
yeah.
Take that self-care and really, you know, be patient with yourself about, you know, don't put the pressure to be instantly successful. Don't put that pressure on yourself. And when other people try to push it on you, say, look, I'm going at the pace that I can. This is the thing that it's a difficult market. It's a difficult time right now, especially right now, to go out there. And it's not helpful to be reminded about the problems you're facing. We're all dealing with them. So just let your family know, like, you know, I'll be the one to tell you how things are going. I'll be the one to tell you about my successes. You don't have to check in. I'll let you know. I would also say you really can't oversell how important it is to stay in touch with your whole network. Mm-hmm. That is so important. And making those connections that can make you successful, that can make you meet someone where something magically happens. And you're just like, oh my gosh, like, how did we never meet each other when we have all these different friends in common? And we are such a great professional pair.
Yeah.
Midway through the PhD, when I started doing that community engaged teaching, I met with the head of the BSW program at Carlo University, and meeting with her because a friend of mine recommended that, you know, they're like, you should really talk to this person because it seems like you guys do a lot of the same stuff. Meeting with her, and then she was like, you should read this book that I wrote about community engagement in the world. And I was like, okay. And now I'm working with her and she's sending me an intern.
What's the book and who's the person's name?
Jessica Friedrichs is the name. Let me get I don't want to mess up the book title. Yeah. So let me, it's called Community-Based Global Learning, The Theory and Practice of Ethical Engagement at Home and Abroad. So yeah, not one of the titles I knew off the top of my head for the full title, but it's a wonderful book about really thinking on the macro level of how you can do community engagement, how you can do work that is impactful for both the individuals reaching out to communities outside of their own, and really addresses the needs of that community. Doesn't just come in and say like, oh, we know what you need, don't worry, we'll give it to you. It's saying like, okay, how to work with them, how to canvas them, how to address those problems. There was a story I heard where it was this community had no green space, and the nonprofit that stepped in to help said like, okay, well, we'll build a park for you.
Yeah.
And then when they built that park, the community was not using it. And they were like, why aren't you using this park? What's going on? And they said, oh, well, we have a wild dog problem. Like, there's so many wild dogs, it's not safe for us to be at these parks. And so it was one of those things where if they had known in advance, if they'd actually taken the time to talk with them and not just assumed on their own what the community problem was, they could have addressed the whole issue at once, but then they had to do it over years. And so those are just like one example of how working with them is important.
Yeah. They were missing that community storytelling piece.
Yeah, exactly.
All right. Obviously, I work in career services at UCA. So did you ever utilize the resources career services offers while attending UCA? This could have been attending a career fair, having your resume reviewed, doing a mock interview, career coaching, any of those resources?
I believe I attended two career fairs. Okay. At the time, was still thinking that I was pretty set on doing grad school. So it was just sort of more of a reconnaissance for me, just seeing what was out there, which I still recommend that people do. You know, even if you have an idea of what you want your future to look like, consider the other possibilities, you know, keep an open mind. I don't believe that I formally had my resume looked at, but I had so many friends in the writing center that I asked to look at my work that I, you know, they weren't, career services, but they were people that could pay attention to the story I was telling in my cover letter, the story I was telling in my CV, and tell me like, is this clear? Is it convincing? Is it compelling? So those are probably the extent of the services that I used at UCA for that. But I did use career services at Duquesne as I was thinking about transitioning into a different field. So it's kind of all about the time and place you're at in life.
Yeah, for sure. If you could do it all over again, would you choose the same path for yourself? And if not, what would you change?
You know, I have thought about this a number of times, and I don't think I would change anything. Because for one thing, I really love my life. I love where I'm at. I am very satisfied, and I wouldn't want to end up anywhere else than where I am now. So I don't want to change any of that. But the other aspect is that the work I did as a student at UCA and as a grad student at Duquesne have been so impactful for me and been so empowering and been such vital moments of growth for me that I wouldn't be the person I am. I wouldn't be doing the kind of work that I think is effective if I hadn't had those moments. So yeah, I would do it all over again.
All right. Last question. Where can students or listeners go to reach out to you if they have questions or would like to connect?
You can find me on LinkedIn, mm-hmm. Jeff Lambert. I think it's Jeff Lambert, PhD, because Jeff Lambert was taken. or like not Jeff Lambert taken, because there's so many Jeff Lamberts, but I was trying to like distinguish myself from the sea of Jeff Lamberts out there. And so I think that's the best way to find me on through any kind of social media, because as I mentioned, I don't have a Facebook or Instagram, but you can also email me. My work email is jlambert@crisiscenternorth.org. And that's probably the best way to get in touch with me if you have any questions.
All right. Well, thank you so much for taking time out of your day and coming on and sharing more about your career experience and the community engagement piece. I feel like I learned a lot, and I hope that our listeners will learn a lot from this too. So,
well, thank you so much for having me, and thanks for all the great questions. It was really fun to do this with you.
Thank you for listening to Noteworthy Networks. Support for this podcast comes from the University of Central Arkansas's Department of Career Services. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, and be sure to follow the podcast on Instagram and Facebook at Noteworthy Networks and Career Services at UCA Career on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. We hope you'll listen in for the next guest and more career advice to come.